and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. My guest today is Dr. Michael J. Kumar Devraj. He's a medical doctor who left government service in 1999 to contest the Sungai Siput constituency in the 10th general elections. He finally won that seat in 2008, where he was. He then became a member of parliament for Sungai Siput for two terms till 2018. And he was the first socialist MP in parliament for more than 40 years. He's currently the chairperson of Party Socialist Malaysia, which he co-founded in 1996 with his NGO colleagues. I'm delighted to welcome him to the show. Dr. J. Kumar, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Doctor, can we begin our conversation perhaps with you telling us what the latest news is on PSM's electoral pact with Pakatan? I mean, how will they be honouring this pact? Has a decision been made as to whether or not you will be contesting in Sungai Siput?
Well, we are still in the dark about that. We had asked for one parliament seat, preferably Sungai Siput, and two state assembly seats. So initially, I mean, what they told us and they told MUDA is that they can only consider seats which they hadn't won. So we said we're okay with that, except for Sungai Siput. We're asking them to make an exception for Sungai Siput. But for the state seats, we are prepared to take two seats that they hadn't won in the 2018 elections. But up till now, we haven't heard anything definitive. Things don't look too good right now. You know, it appears we may not get the electoral pact that we asked for. But we're still hopeful. We're still waiting.
Well, why the long wait? Why the indecision? Why the dithering? And why do you think that it might not turn out the way you hoped it would?
Well, I guess there are a lot of factions within the component parties of PH, and the different groups also want their members to stand. So there's a lot of pressure on the leaders. So, and I'm not sure how much they value the input that PSM can give at the level of parliament, at the level of ideas. We think, we believe that we have something to contribute, you know, because our perception is a bit different because we have got a lot of grassroots, so exposure. So we'd like to have this opportunity to articulate their problems, their views.
Okay, can you maybe elaborate?
Elaborate. I mean, okay, things like, for example, farmers facing eviction. We are handling about right now 14 different areas where we have vegetable farmers facing eviction. So we've got a whole set of analysis and what needs to be done about it. We've got very strong ideas regarding food security. We formed a coalition of vegetable farmers, livestock rearers, fishermen, paddy farmers. It's a coalition.
Right.
And, things like that. So those things, if we can get in and speak, it'll be good.
I mean, I don't discount the work that PSM does. I understand, you know, you've been long on the ground working with people, particularly marginalized communities, communities that have been overlooked by policymakers and politicians. But when it's time for elections, often the key consideration is who will win, who is the winnable candidate to be fielded. What does PSM bring to the table in this perspective?
Well, I think a PSM candidate would have a slight edge over the other possible candidates from PH because of the work we do at the grassroots. But of course, if we just go on our own without being a PH member, then we will not, because the main support is for PH. There'll be a bit of marginal support for PSM candidate for the work done if he's standing on a PH logo. So that's the difference.
What do you consider trade-offs of participating in electoral politics? I'm wondering, because you've chosen politics as the platform to be of service to the community. You why did you choose a life of service after being a medical doctor in government service? Why did you choose a life of service through the platform of politics? And what do you consider some of the trade-offs, Dr. Kumar?
No, I think the getting a seat in a state assembly or parliament is not the only way in which you can serve. You know, I think you do a lot of things: mobilizing people, analyzing the problem, lobbying, media work, educating the public. But for us, having one or two people in the state assemblies, in parliaments, would help. It'll be one additional platform we can use. So it's not like our work will grind to a halt if we don't get a seat or we don't manage to get in. There's no problem. We'll carry on working. But our work would be easier. We can do more if we have this additional platform. Right. The trade-offs are, I think, parliament and assembly are profoundly corrupting. You know, the persons going in there are immediately enticed into a very higher, upper middle class kind of life. And there's a lot of strong corporate influence on leaders going in there. So you've got to have people who are able to withstand that. That is the downside.
Okay. And working with PH on this, I mean, was there consensus within PSM for the choices of having to, participate in elections, for having to have an electoral pact with Pakatan Harapan? I do wonder, because PSM has always maintained an egalitarian structure. Was there consensus among members to work together or to work again with Pakatan, particularly after the history that Pakatan has?
Yeah, you're right. PSM discusses all these things, and we've been discussing it since 2018, where we thought that people would support us because of the work we have done, and we found that no, people look at the big picture. They want to see who's going to control Putrajaya. So for elections, people look at the big picture. So a small party putting forward 5 candidates, 10 candidates doesn't cut ice, you know. So we discussed it, and the decision was taken to attempt to have an electoral pact with PH. That was a party decision. Okay. Not taken now, taken about a couple of years ago, saying that we can't stand solo again. We shouldn't stand solo. I mean, if we want to win, we've got to stand as one of, as a part of a coalition. And then looked around at the coalitions, the best coalition right now, it's not perfect, but it's better than the other two, was Pakatan Harapan. So we said, okay, let's. So that's a decision taken by the membership.
Lesser evil, less of all evils.
We're living in the real world, you know, so I think you cannot be a perfectionist, you know. So, yeah, there are limitations, there are mistakes, but at the point in time, we would still say Pakatan Harapan is the better of the coalitions. And even if you're not taken on board, we would still say that, tell the people that, no, Pakatan Harapan is the better option right now. Mm.
What's your relationship, Dr. Kumar, with Pakatan right now? I mean, I know you've made some quite public statements about the need for PH to learn from the mistakes that they made when they were in Putrajaya, you know, the need for some self-reflection among opposition members. Has that view, has that, you know, constructive criticism or constructive advice been well received by Pakatan leaders?
I don't know, you know, because you don't have access to the top leaders. But I have friends, and the PSM leaders have friends among Pakatan politicians, and we're on good terms generally.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that advice? If I may quote what you said, if we do not learn what we did wrong in 2018 to 2020, there is a greater chance we will repeat the mistakes if we ever get a second opportunity at forming government. What were some of the mistakes or the need for self-reflection? What was that based on from your observations?
Okay. I think the Pakatan failed to consolidate its support, especially among the Malay electorate. From our assessment, about 25 to 30% of the Malay electorate actually voted for Pakatan Harapan in 2018. But by the time the Johor elections, the Malacca elections came, that had come down to about maybe 7 or 8%, a big drop in the support intellectorate for Pakatan. And I think some of the reasons for that were things like the cutting of subsidies, for example, cutting of subsidies for the smallholders, cutting of subsidies for the fishermen, the bringing in the requirement that you people with the SSM registration for enterprises no longer could get the BRIM. So that cuts off about almost a million people, you know, about a million, that's the million SMEs, you know. So all these things, I think, gave a shock to the Malay B40, who were also getting very strong propaganda from UMNO and PAS that, you know, they are done in now because they got a government that is not sensitive, that is not supportive of them. So the propaganda that UMNO was coming out with was inadvertently made stronger by this kind of policy missteps. So I think these are issues that they that the Pakatan Harapan leadership didn't realize, that they had to consolidate just the rhetoric on going against the corrupt people and going against one MDB wasn't enough. These issues of real, issues about poverty, about support, cash transfers are also important.
So what would the lesson be there to learn there, Doctor? What would have been the key lesson from those missteps?
I think we got to understand where people are at and address how we're going to resolve those issues. I mean, if, for example, Pakatan had maintained those subsidies, one, and secondly, maybe implemented something like an old age pension scheme for all Malaysians. That had gone across very well, even to the Malay populace. And an old age pension scheme, we're talking about something like $500 a month for all those above 65. It'll come to about 12 billion a year, roughly. Something quite affordable. But it'll be very, very helpful to the people. And it'll made people see, oh, it's very good, this government is doing this. The other thing they could have done is put some money into improving the conditions in the low-cost flats, which are now looking like slums. All the privately run low-cost flats look like slums. So if they put some money into that and repaired the lifts, repaired the stairways and all that. So I think things like that could have been done. And I think they should have looked at, it's very good rhetoric if you're campaigning among non-Malays to say, let's do away with racial quotas, completely do away in education. But okay, what would happen if you did that right now, if you do away completely with racial quotas, what percentage of the entrance into medical school, law school, engineering school, accounting would be Bumiputra at this point in time? Go entirely on meritocracy. Only on merit, you just don't do away the quotas, as some people will say. I don't know, I think you'll have a predominance of non-Malays more than their population share. So it's not something that's going to fly. So we've got to discuss those kind of things. The quota system has disadvantaged and marginalized non-Malays, especially non-Malay poor who can't go overseas, who can't go to private. But at the same time, to say do away with it completely now, tomorrow, is that something that it's going to sell, it's going to fly? So I think you've got to sit down and think, the standard phrases and the standard demands that we have when you talk to a non-Malay population, a non-Malay constituency, is that something that you can implement when you become a ruler of the government, when you run the government? You've got to take into account other viewpoints, other anxieties, and how you address it. If you don't address it properly, then people will make the decision that, assessment that you are not sensitive to their needs, that you are dangerous to them and their children. So I think these are things that Pakatan, I'm not sure has done it before, after this or not, but, after the debacle of 2020, but these are the kind of things that Pakatan has to look at. How do you face in the changes in a way that everyone feels comfortable, that people don't feel threatened? I think that is what you need to do. And I think that was what they failed in 2018. We've been quite honest about that because we believe that if you want to be an ally, you want to be a friend, you just can't butter up people. And the truth has got to be spoken, You've got to do it politely, but it's got to be done. Right. So these are things we haven't seen that much of outward discussion on these things. So the fear is still there, you know, that they may still have missteps on issues like this because this hasn't been actually brought to the table and discussed.
Do you think it is a lack of understanding of, you know, some of the issues that you said, the looking at how there are structural issues about the causes of marginalization and poverty within, say, the Bumi community that cannot be undone with the idea of reform or doing away with race-based politics or policies? How do we reconcile, Dr. Kumar, reconcile the need and desire for reform, but over six decades of entrenched race-based policies? How do we move towards reform, break that inertia, make that step without having these knee-jerk reactions of the pendulum swinging to the other side?
No, I think it's quite not that difficult, really. You know, I think even the Malay community would not be against efforts to prevent kleptocracy. You know, I mean, if you look at the Malay WhatsApp groups as well, I mean, a number of them, and they're quite annoyed, they're quite unhappy with the fact that, you know, the elite, the political elite, are living it up, they're making so much money, they pay so much, they got this much of business, and they live in these kind of houses. There's so much criticism on that. So I think cutting down those kinds of, you know, wastages, you know, I mean, we know, like, for example, you know, in Sungai Sipur or any other rural constituency, when money is made available to improve conditions in the village, repairing or building some PPR houses, they're aware there's a lot of leakage to the local politicians, to the local contractors who give substandard. Those kind of things, I think you act on those kind of things, I think the Malay masses will be very happy with you. But you go and cut their subsidies, the rubber tapping subsidy, the fisherman subsidy, the prim, you go and touch those things, then they get worried. I mean, do you understand? So I think the problem is many of the PH politicians, especially DAP, are in urban areas, and they don't really understand Malay poverty in the kampongs. And if you don't do that, you don't understand that, then I think you are not able to have a program that is sympathetic, that has empathy for them. I think that's what's important. You've got to have that degree of empathy, you know.
All right.
I mean, if you look at Sungai Sipur, there's so much of underemployment among Malay youth because factories generally prefer to employ migrant workers who are prepared to work 12-hour shifts and who are scared to argue back. So you get, in a way, better productivity, but it's slave-like conditions. Like some of the NGOs have been reporting us to international organizations for slave-like conditions. So we cannot fault our youth, Indian Malay youth, for not working under the slave-like conditions and saying you've been lazy. And we're looking at that, how can we reduce that? How can we make it possible for them to be employed, you know, in these factories? Because there's so much underemployment. We've got to address, so these are issues that had to be identified. And the ways around that, we start discussing it, there are ways around that, you know? So I feel this is something that's not been done. And this is something that where PSM can give very valuable input because we are there. We know the issues. Mm. So we are able to identify the issues and suggest some ways out.
Right. Well, so PSM really working at that grassroots level, and your information is from the trenches about the problems that are faced by everyday people. What are your thoughts on how the national level discussion of policies and issues, how might that translate to the grassroots level? Do people care about reform, about institutional reform? Are they talking about, you know, food security, about cost of living? What are the things that PSM is hearing from the people that you work with every day?
Yeah, I think economic issues are a big issue, you know. I mean, the cost of living, the cost of food, not having enough income. These are definitely very, very strong issues, you know. And people are concerned. People are definitely concerned. So these are issues we need to address. And some of the issues are built very structural. You know, for example, you know, if you look at Malaysia, our GDP has increased from about 10.6 billion in 1970 to about 1,600 billion in last year. So it's a huge increase. And if you do the math, you look at the increase in the CPI, it's about fivefold. The increase in population, it's about threefold. You get about an increase per capita in real terms of tenfold. Tenfold increase in GDP per capita in the last 50 years. But the increase in real wages, in the median wage, the median wage of factory workers, has gone up by about 1.5. It's 1.5 times what it was in 70. But per capita has gone up tenfold. So there's something we call wage suppression, where the wealth goes, we're creating wealth in this country, but the wealth is going to the top companies or going out of the country. So these are things that we have to address. These are the very socialist issues that we have to look at and see why is this happening and how do we address it.
So on that note, can I ask you about when you say things like this, these are very socialist issues, and I do want to ask you to clarify what socialism today, what socialism in the 21st century looks like for a country like Malaysia. You speak of this, looking at the growth, looking at an alternative plan for Malaysia's development. But what is the 21st century socialist like yourself look like?
I think we have to be very sober and see what is possible. It's no longer, 60 years ago, there was the Soviet Union, there was the socialist bloc, that a country could break away from the capitalist system and say, you guys go to hell, we have other friends, so we're going to reorganize our whole economy differently. That doesn't exist anymore. There is no separate socialist economic system that any small country could break away and go to. We are still part of the world global system, which is capitalist. Even China, under a communist government, is part of this world capitalist system. So we got to think of things like, okay, how do we make adjustments in the way we are articulated? For example, in Malaysia, when you're having a conversation about how do we raise minimum wages, the problem that the ministry will tell us is that if you raise minimum wages too high, then you won't get investment. Foreign direct investment will go down because it's cheaper for them to go to Vietnam or go to Thailand. So the global chains will go there instead of coming here. And even people who are here, even Malaysian investors, may go and invest in Thailand, because the wages here are now too high for them. So they're saying that if you raise minimum wages too high in Malaysia, we'll end up with a loss of investment, loss of jobs, unemployment, and loss of taxes. So essentially it's going to be, self-defeating. So now we have been discussing issues like that, and we're saying, okay, now what happens if we go back to ASEAN, this ASEAN Free Trade Agreement, and we tweak that, and we agree that everyone in the region increases minimum wage by 10% over the next 10 years, 10% per year next 10 years, but we do it in tandem. So not saying come to the same minimum wage, because right now, I think Cambodia's minimum wage is only about 700 Malaysian ringgit per month. Ours is 1,005. So we cannot ask them to come to ours, because then they lose the comparative advantage. But if you go up 10%, you go to 770 and we go up 10%. And everyone does 10%. That means we stop. In fact, we reverse the race to the bottom in minimum wages in order to get investment.
Right.
And that way, we're increasing the money, we're increasing aggregate demand, we're increasing the scope, the market for small businessmen. All our SMEs, the small businesses will have more. It's kind of a win-win situation. So I think the socialists of the 21st century, we're talking of things like that. How do we redistribute wealth in a way that doesn't wreck the national economy, in a way that is just, So it's much more evolutionary, and, it's not like disrupting the whole system, because you can't right now. I mean, Malaysia, we have 70% of our exports make up 70% of our GDP. I mean, in terms of value, it's 70% of our GDP. So there's no way of us saying we're going to break away from this capitalist system and have our own. We can't. But you've got to make these kind of changes.
Right.
And how do you build a social safety net? That's the other thing we can talk about,
Do you think, Dr. Kumar, So, sorry to interrupt you. We've just got a couple of minutes left now. I do want to ask you, do you think that because of all the trials and tribulations that we've been through with the pandemic and we've seen kind of world order being a question, do you think that particularly in Malaysia, are more people getting interested in socialism, in an alternative view of development of society, particularly within the young generation? Are you seeing any kind of increase of interest in PSM numbers or PSM membership?
Only a little, not what we like to see. The problem is the political discourse in this country has been so ethnicized. So I think a lot of people's minds are poisoned by the ethnic issues, by the religious kind of dialogue, by the exclusive kind of discussion taking place. It is a problem, something that we are fighting against, you know. So I think most people, I mean, if you take a socialist frame, phrase, they have false consciousness. They don't understand what their underlying problems are. I mean, for the poor Indians, for the poor Malays, for the poor Chinese, their problems are the same. Cost of living is high, the cost of housing is high, the wages have been suppressed, there's no long-term savings. It's all common to them. Yet they mobilize under politically charged political programs, I mean, racially charged political programs. So that's the problem. So that's our task now in PSM, to try and make people understand, hey, look, the commonalities in terms of our problems, the things that we need low-cost housing for everyone, we need low-cost PPR housing for rent, in all our major cities, and that's for everyone. We need a better healthcare system, we need a better public transport system, not for one particular race, for all the races. And we need to come together to fight for that. The other issues are there, but you know, the issues of language and of religion, but what's in our constitution is fair enough, let's stick to that. Let's not make those the issues, let's make the bread and butter issues the main point of our political program. That is what we're putting forward to the people. But I cannot say that we are on, you know, that people are coming in droves. I think people are still affected by the intense ethnic politicking that's taken place.
Dr. Kumar, thank you so much for speaking with me today. That was my conversation with co-founder and chairperson of PSM, Dr. J. Kumar Devraj. And that wraps up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching and good night.